Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Spates Waterlad podcast. Thank you for listening and a massive thank you to anyone who has shared the podcast to friends, family or on social media, whatever it is. Super grateful for all the support and of course grateful for the support from our major sponsor Spates for helping bring this episode to you. Good on you, mate. What a lad. Well, we've done it. We've finally got him on, one of the all-time great lads, and many would regard him as the greatest Marco of all time. And then you speak to any of the Highlanders from the 2015 team, and they'll tell you how influential he was in their side winning the 2015 Super Rugby title. And he also is, in my opinion, probably the best player to have never been capped internationally. While post-playing, he also went on to become one of the best defensive coaches in the game, and he has an incredible story, which I'm really looking forward to talking to. One of the greatest men of all time, it is the great Shane Christie. Welcome, mate.
I love your intros, Joe. I love them. Thank you.
Mate, I spoke all true words there, like some good memories of you playing for the Marco and the Highlanders, even New Zealand Maldives, but you've had a hell of a career, and I know it's such a cool story because I obviously met you here at Nelson Rugby Football Club. Great to be here in the club rooms to do this podcast, but your journeys are not your typical rugby journey. Like you really ground through the early days, eh?
Yeah. A lot of hard work at the start. And yeah, it's like, how did I end up making it as a professional rugby player? It's like, whoa, that happened, yeah. But it took a long time. I was late. I was like 25, 26 before I made Tasman.
Yeah. We will get into all that. But how are you feeling now? Like a lot of people, probably a lot of the questions that came in was, where is he? What's he been doing? You were coaching the Highlanders. You were coaching Tasman. Now you're not. So what are you up to?
The last year, I've just taken a year off. Yeah. I actually got cut from the Landers, Joe.
Did you?
Yeah. I didn't tell you that, eh?
Nah, I thought you left. Oh, you got cut.
They cut me.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a good story.
Tell it.
Straight away?
Yeah. Let's dive straight in.
We had end of season, like, breakup. Rog gets me in the office and says, like, you've been good. We've been pretty happy with the way you've coached, and we just want to go a different direction.
Mm.
And I was like, sweet, jumped up, left. And I'd spoken to Dermo a little bit before that, like a few weeks, and just the way the season had gone. And the couple of years that I was down there, I enjoyed it, and the experience was good, but there was a lot more frustrating days than I enjoyed. You know, it was a grind, man. For me, trying to work through full-time coaching with my concussion and stuff, and then the pressure of trying to get into that level at coaching.
Yeah.
And then I guess we were a battler team that wasn't always performing that well. So there was pressures in the whole experience, but I couldn't go back if it was going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
If I was working really hard to get the D right, and then the attack wasn't the good, and I didn't feel like the expectation on the standard and the commitment and some of our attack was probably, in my opinion, was letting us down. And of course I could be wrong, and things aren't always as you seem, but it was just like, I felt like if I had an involvement in the attack, it could have been the attacking breakdown or 22 and tech, I think I could have had a better influence in how we were scoring tries and that. And
yeah,
I couldn't go back if it was just me doing the D, because it was hard, man. I was so frustrated. Yeah, I felt like that. I felt like at times there wasn't enough expectation on how our attack was going.
Yeah.
And the execution and the standard that we set, I just didn't believe that it was the right way forward.
Yeah.
So that was a cool experience. And, like, I think they're going to get Kenny Lind down there next year, which is awesome. I've heard he's a really good coach. Goody said he's good.
Yeah. But if Goody said he's good, he's good.
It's got to be good. But, you know, I looked at the Landers this year and they the same problems.
Mm.
And, man, I'm happy I didn't go back, because I couldn't get through another year like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. if it wasn't for surfing, I would have been struggling down there. That's the good thing about Dunedin. And the boys are amazing, man. There's a lot of really cool guys. The coaches are awesome, but I just think the expectation sometimes isn't right down there.
Mm.
And when Jamie was there, it was all on.
He bought that.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. People like the stories that even that you hear from the players that have been under Jamie and Burles when he was on a club girl or something, like, he was for real.
Yeah. Headshots only.
Yeah.
Toughen up. 5 a.m. camps.
He's the man, and the boys respected that. And I think like a team that, for us anyway, they don't have the superstars down there.
Mm.
So you have to be real. If you want to win against teams like you guys, the Crusaders, the best players in the world, you've got to bring an edge. You've got to be different.
Yeah.
And it has to be your mindset and expectation, I think.
Yeah.
How else can you do it?
Mate, you can't. You're right you can't. On, mate. How have they let you go? That's incredible. But
it was funny. That's a funny story.
Good start. But you mentioned, like, struggling down there with your head, like coaching full time while still suffering from concussion. Like, how is your head now? And like, what does suffering through concussion look like for you these days?
The last 6 months have been tough since losing Bill, man. That's been an incredible experience for me, and then seeing how it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So without going into that just right now, that really rattled me. And I suppose when with my concussion, and like I think a lot of people, when you're under serious stress, you can get bad headaches, all your symptoms come back.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a threshold of your energy, and every time your battery drops, if you get put under stress, it drops again, and then it just takes longer to get it back. So when I'd worked for, I did a season, my first season in 21 with the Landers, and then went straight into Tassie.
Mm.
At the end of those two seasons, I was done.
Yeah.
Like, I was buggered. My head had been, I was getting heaps of symptoms, and I was just grinding through. Still loved it, and it was good to get back to Tasman and refresh and be under the sun and awesome culture.
Mm.
But going back into that 22 super season, I was really struggling. And I guess that is an experience that I wouldn't have signed 2 years for the Landers, even though I said, hey, I don't know how this is going to go. You know, I'm trying to get into full-time work and full-time coaching, and then the change of pressure and stuff, it's a bit more intense. But once I'd gone through that first year for those two seasons, I was probably operating at like 40-50%.
Mm.
And then you get through the next season. So last July, I got back to Tassie, and I'd taken the Tasman season off to recover.
Yeah.
I didn't start feeling good till like January or February.
Far out.
Yeah, man.
So what are you feeling? Just headaches and tired? Headaches,
fogginess.
Yeah.
Like ringing in my ears, vision problems. Sometimes if I'm bad, I'll have issues with my speech. And
shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you may have noticed different things in me and my mood. And
The thing I remember is coaching with you was – like sometimes just having to go off and have a sleep, you know, like everyone would go for a coffee, but you'd go sit in the van and just sleep to rest.
Recharge.
And I was like, far out, that's pretty crazy.
But yeah. You just lose your energy faster, you know. You've got so much, and you can be like that and you feel and operate maybe like a normal person. But then when you lose your energy, you've got to get it back somehow. And if you don't refill it, it takes a lot longer to come right.
Mm.
That's the other thing. So if I've got headaches and stuff and I'm not feeling that well, you might feel like that for a day or two and have a couple of good night's sleeps. It might take me a week to come right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is there light at the end of the tunnel, or like, it's been, how long's it been since,
2016 I started having my concussion problems.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah. There's light, man. Yeah. I know that I can come right because, like I said, this January, February, I was feeling really good, and I was exercising hard out. I got a chest freezer and I was ice bathing every day.
Oh, yeah.
Like 15, 20 minutes.
True.
Ice baths 3 or 4 times a day.
Oh, wow.
I brought a sauna. I was doing hot colds every day, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's for real because I'm like...
What's happened? Are you still doing it?
Yeah, I started back up after, like, just recently. Like,
oh, yeah.
With the stress of going through with Billy, and then I helped with the girls' team.
Oh, yeah.
Like when you're busy and you're trying to do normal stuff, your health goes out the back door.
Yeah. You know?
So I didn't have the energy to get back in the sauna, bro.
Yeah.
Or into the ice bath, because it's hard. You don't want to sit in an ice bath for 10 minutes, man.
Nah.
It sucks, but I know for my life and to come right, I've got to do it. And there's other things that you can do, but I think the main thing is ice bathing, cold therapy, high intensity exercise. When I can get my threshold up, I can actually run for 30, 40 minutes, but it just takes time to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And then fasting.
Oh, yeah.
So I've been doing heaps of fasting the last year, and it's been a crazy year, but what does it look like for me in the future? I suppose I want to try, and I've been speaking to New Zealand Rugby and losing Bill, and like, man, he had bad concussion when he finished his rugby career and he had other things going on, but seeing his behaviour and, you know, the way he was around different things in his life, I can see that he's still having issues with his head.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't want to get to a stage where if you don't look after yourself, that's where you end up. And I think it's really sad to see that he couldn't get the right help, because, like, we're all responsible for our own health, that's for sure.
Mm.
But when you end up with concussion from rugby, you might think that, like it is when you're playing, you get help for basically everything.
Mm.
But when you come off contract and then onto ACC and the public medical system, you're by yourself. Mm. If you don't have a strong partner that can handle your mood swings and the different things you deal with cognitive issues, or a family that understands it really well, you're by yourself. And so it's an interesting thing. It'd be cool to talk about that, and we'll have a yarn and see where we can come up with, because there's probably not enough in New Zealand rugby in prevention.
Yeah.
And then I think for me anyway, if I hadn't had so many.
How many did you have? No idea.
Heaps, man.
Mm.
I was thinking about this before I came in. My first concussion was in Taka when I was 18, 19, playing for Nelson Club Senior Bees. And I'd had a head knock and I was feeling a bit drowsy, and the bus ride up to the top was like, shit, this is no good, I'm feeling crook.
Mm.
The boys were having a few beers, bus trip home, and I tried to have a beer and I was like, man, I'm crook as. Jumped out and spewed, vomited outside the bus, and I was like, shit, this isn't good. I've had a head knock, told the staff, and I was like, you just chill. And that was my first concussion when I was 19.
Mm.
And then my next one was, I think I was around 21, out here on T Park, and there was a trial maybe for the Bays team, and I tackled someone and hit my head on their hip.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the time, but Kahu stopped me from walking the wrong direction, pulled me off the field, and I remember I came right into the ambulance, and he was like, what's your name, what's your address? And I couldn't remember for 10 or 15 minutes.
Shit.
Yeah. And then that took me, you know, a couple of weeks off work, and then a couple of weeks just gradually getting back into it. And I suppose that was before I even started playing senior rugby, you know, like, and then went into provincial rugby for years and then super for a couple of years. But the key thing that I absolutely think is true is that I had too many in a short period where I wasn't quite right.
Mm.
And like a lot of players, we want to play.
So you knew you weren't quite right?
I didn't really understand that, yeah, I may have concussion problems.
Mm.
Like I was getting the concussion tests, and I was getting a little bit dizzy during the week, and I had a neck problem from probably a head knock that, you know, pinched my neck, and that's how you can also get those referring headaches.
Yeah.
I realised I wasn't right, and then I thought, right, I got through the Tasman season, and then I couldn't run high intensity.
Because you'd get a headache.
Because I just get, like, blurry, foggy, dizzy. And then I thought, sweet, I'm just going to do weights. Did weights, and then went back into the 2017 super season. Then contact I was still having problems. And then running, I was still getting issues with my high-intensity running for certain periods. So I tried to do, we did a pretty good 3-month return-to-play protocol with the doctor at the time, Greg McLeod, and he really looked after me and he tried to get me back. And after two setbacks of like high intensity running for 30 or 40 minutes and I couldn't do it, then I knew it was probably time to pull pin.
Mm.
But so yeah, I had a lot of head knocks like a lot of boys do, But the key thing is that a lot of my head knocks weren't actually like they might have been, because you're with different doctors, eh?
Yeah.
And in different teams, and it's not always clear, and it's not all the information isn't connected or collected. So it's like, I think that's the big thing that we could do better in rugby is, as soon as you start playing age grade rugby, if you have a head knock that needs to be noted down, and it doesn't matter who you're with, if you continue that sport in a contact sport, you need to make sure that you've got these concussions at different periods. It doesn't matter what doctor you're with or what team you're with, they need to be noted in some sort of file system that that you can have. If you have 5 or 10 over a couple of years, you've got to take a year off.
Yeah,
or even maybe a couple. Like Tane Robinson is one that's had a few in the last couple of years. Like, I see he's back and he's doing really well, but if he was to get a couple more next year, he's got to think about, man, this is probably something I need to look at and have a year off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you have done differently, like, if you could go back in time? Would you have finished your career earlier? Would you have taken a bigger break earlier? Well, how would you have done it?
The season, the 2016 season, when I was getting them bad, I'd come into Tasman and I'd had a really average 2016 Super, and I was disappointed with that, and then it's a collective thing with the player and the doctors.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's better now, but only, how long's that? 7, 8 years ago. It wasn't as good back then, and we were a little bit more, not lenient, but we didn't understand that, man, if you've had a couple of head knocks in one season, this guy's red flag big time. Which now, if you get a couple of head knocks in a couple of seasons, everyone knows that guy's sort of in a, you got to be wary. And if he gets another couple, he's out. Even the return to play protocols were only 5 or 7 days back then.
Yeah.
That's been changed. And really just recently. Mm. Now it's 12 days minimum for someone under 21 or something. Mm. So I think me personally, how would I have changed things? It's a maturity thing. You've got to say, man, I've had a head knock. I'm not feeling good.
Yeah.
I've got to take a couple of weeks off, and then the doctors have got to take the lead and make sure that that's what it is now. But back then, I don't know what I could have done, Jim. I was a different person, you know. I didn't see it like I do now.
Yeah. I don't think many kids do, or many kids will. That's why it's such a hard area. Like, you can fake those concussion tests or pass those tests if you want to and say that you're feeling sweet and get back out there. But you're right, you've got to take a little bit of accountability on it, eh?
Yeah, you have to. Yeah. I was talking to Fozzie.
Oh, yeah.
Last week, and we were talking about the concussion test, and the culture back when we were starting out was like, the first test you do, you know, if you do it well, but if you're a little bit rough, it probably means that you're going to pass the next one if you're not quite right. So the culture wasn't good amongst the players.
Yeah.
And that's changed a lot, because we've seen so many injuries with concussion and people losing their careers and having ongoing issues. But it took time to maybe build that culture of concussion safety up.
Yeah.
And I've been surprised it's taken so long, because it's been happening in NFL for years.
Mm. Yeah, and I feel like even NRL's a little bit more behind. It looks like guys are out and then they somehow push off the trainer or like go for the HR and come back on. And I'm like, well, that's, I don't know how he's managed to do that. But
did you see that there was a doco on a dude that lost his life up in Auckland? Club player in league.
Nah.
He had a head knock and it was quite bad. He was getting bad symptoms for a few months. I forget his name. I watched it on Sunday. And he came back. The doctors, his GP, said you should probably take a month off. And he returned to play after a week. He took 1 week off, returned to play the next week, got another head knock, and he died on the field.
Ah, right.
And ACC brought out some legislation that automatic 3 week stand down if you've had a head knock. And they did that in a month, and then league brought out some regulations saying the similar thing, and they did that within a week.
Sure.
So as how many more people need to die before we do anything? And I think the awareness thing isn't where it should be. There's no way. I've been thinking about this a lot since Bill, and there was a lady, I forget, I think she's got a couple of businesses around the country. Her name's Helen. She's with the Southland team, and she's done some concussion stuff for Hunty.
Oh yeah,
and in the All Blacks.
Yeah,
she was had a little like a speech up here, a bit of a meeting, and at the pavilion, I went to that about 2 or 3 months ago, and there was 10 or 12 people there.
True.
Yeah, So in a perfect world, you'd have all the club coaches there, the age grade, women's and men's, and educate the coaches so we get a better culture around concussion. And there was a couple people there, mountain bikers, a couple parents that had kids that had concussion from rugby.
Yeah.
And then whose responsibility is that to start organising these things? Well, let's start with the provincial unions, and then NZRU probably need to take responsibility about getting these seminars into rugby, because we've got a problem with concussion, but there's not enough awareness. And is it because we're scared of being honest about what's happening with concussion? Like in rugby, we're trying to go towards the pressure, Jim. Let's just confront it, be open and honest, and then try and make sure we have a better awareness around it and people are more educated so that it just doesn't keep on happening. Because at the worst case, it's the multiple head knocks over a short period that's going to mean you have long issues later on. But a couple head knocks is, you're fine. You're sweet. You're going to be all good in a couple months or a few weeks, but not consecutive head knocks. And from a young age, if you don't keep track of them.
Yeah, be patient with it, eh? But I think that's why having you on this podcast is so awesome, being able to give some awareness to the concussion world and share your thoughts and insights to it all, because you've been through it all. You know that what it feels like, and to be able to share your thoughts and for people to hear it, young players might be in the situation, make them realise that, man, I'm not quite right. Maybe I won't play, or maybe I will take a month stand down because I don't want to have these multiple concussions in a row where I could potentially die or have long-term injuries. So it's pretty scary.
Yeah, and this is what your show's about, man. It's cool. It's cool what you're doing, Jim. How cool. It's probably needed more often than what we get in the mainstream media and individual journalism and podcasts, is how you maybe can get more real, genuine communication going on that isn't, you know, censored.
Yeah, that's it.
And about concussion, you know, with Billy's passing and his service out here, there was a real fear around talking about mental health and concussion and what he went through leading up to his suicide. And there were hundreds of people in the pavilion as friends that knew what he was like, but that was hardly addressed. And then there were probably a few hundreds of people, maybe 1,000 people online, I don't know. But
I remember tuning in, watching it. And
where were you?
I was at the airport in Christchurch about to catch a flight to one of our games, and I remember you getting up and speaking. And
yeah, well, that wasn't genuine. It wasn't for Bill. It was anything but the truth of what had happened to Bill. Like, he'd done things in those last few years around trying to get his health right, man, and a lot of people really tried to help him, and his family tried to help him, and his mum spent 3 years with him trying to keep him calm and get him on the right direction. And but Bill was, he found it quite hard to change your lifestyle. And that's, it's tough. I found it really hard to change the way I was, sort of just, you got to change how you are. And when you're feeling good, you need to remember that if you carry on like you were, with like sleeping or eating and overexerting yourself, you're probably going to have a setback. So it's a complete change of lifestyle. And for Bill, that he found that really hard. And I think that without the right support and stuff, it can lead to something where you get bad mental health. And there was a real fear to be honest about what he experienced. And when I spent some time looking into where he was for those couple months after, it's like there was nothing in his life that couldn't have been fixed with close friends and family. But because of the way he was probably feeling, he pushed a lot of people away because he didn't want to be a burden on anyone. You know, he was really suffering mentally, and it was because too many people, myself included, man, as one of his good friends at a time, that I couldn't understand that I needed to be there for him just to listen. I couldn't I tried to be the help that I thought he needed, but it's not right. You know, we don't, everyone's different. And going back to the service, it was like, it's okay to be honest about people having mental health stuff and be honest about, we had a rugby coach that finished his career with concussion and we're not even going to address that and try and bring more awareness for the younger players and the current players because if we don't be honest about what's happening, man, we ain't going to go forward very well.
What does that help? Like you spoke about the type of help that he needed. Like when you do see someone struggling, I'm sure a lot of listeners will know of someone who they think, far out, he's struggling. Like, what is the best thing in your opinion to help them?
Billy just needed someone to listen to, I think, and then he couldn't, like, he had a real problem with boundaries. He was one of the most caring, loving people I know. Over the last couple of years, he had 3 homeless people living at his house, Jim.
True.
Looking after them, people that he'd met, and he knew that they needed a helping hand up, and he took them in under their wing, but he probably wasn't capable of doing that because he needed to help himself. So he needed real strong guidance around him that understood his condition and maybe monitored him on a daily or weekly basis, where I think you probably need a couple people in your family, a couple close friends that really care about you, a specialist, a GP, someone in the union, and create a team around someone that's finished with concussion. And if that team understands the player or the person quite well and then, say, has a tough couple months and pushes a couple of them away and that relationship breaks down, then someone else needs to jump in. And the team around that person, they can help, but they rely on each other so they don't all take the burden, you know?
Yeah.
And then have that going for, and it might take 3 or 4 years, you know? But with the medical system at ACC, it's like you've got a case manager and you'll have a specialist and maybe a GP that can help you, but they're not your family or your friends. And if you don't have that partner, and if you don't have that family set up that can actually support you and understand, because it's really isolating, concussion. It's hard for people to understand what you're going through, and it takes a group of people to actually be around them consistently and just check in on what's happening. And Bill sort of pushed people away and then ended up being really isolated, and he was going through tough times, and I don't think anyone really understood how bad he was.
Have you got that group around you? Like, you speak about people with concussion needing that support. Have you got that support that you need?
I do. Holly's been back in New Zealand.
Oh, true.
Since this March or something, and because I was really buggered after Bill's, I ended up staying with her for a couple months, and she was just a good person to talk to. She knows me well, and she's been helping me with, I've been getting a little bit of therapy and some things to try and get my head right as well. And then I'm looking at some different things that I can do for, like, my diet and concussion, like that hyperbolic chamber and stuff like that. And there's a couple of things that I'm going to look into to try and get past the stage I'm at. But I've got a close friend that I've been talking to, Craig. I caught up with Craig the other day and Craig Moore. I've got a group of people that I can rely on. And if I got to a stage where I thought I was in danger of going downhill or feeling like I was suicidal, then I'll give you a ring.
I hope you do.
You know, I've learned a lot since Bill, bro, and I think that's one. Like, I messaged Bill in August and I was still trying to help him. Like, I thought he needed help, man. It wasn't right. And he was reaching out for help then, but I didn't see it. But then he wasn't able to say, man, I'm not right, I need help, come and see me. Which it takes a lot, I think.
Yeah.
And then when you see a really close friend take their life, and then it's just like there's nothing that is a problem. People care about you. And I think he didn't realise that people all over the country loved that dude.
Mm.
He played for so many teams and he inspired so many players and people that were older, more experienced, younger.
Yeah, yeah.
Like he was a character.
Yeah.
But he couldn't quite reach out and just say it how it is. And because we're scared to say the truth about a lot of things like concussion.
Mm.
How can we have a service for someone that was an absolute legend in the Marco jersey and we couldn't speak, his friends couldn't speak? So we've got to get over ourselves, and this is what's happening all around the world and in our country, not just about concussion, but we're very scared of hurting feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want to say the truth about things anymore because we're worried that it's going to cause more damage then, but it's not.
Yeah.
You know, truth hurts, but it's temporary, and how do you get progress without it?
Yeah, and it's something you've always done, eh? Even since I've known you, you've always been one of those guys who have just told it how it is, like no sugarcoating stuff, and I think that's why you're such a great coach, because people knew it was coming from the right place, and if it hurts, then it's probably true. So, and it's to make you get better. So, something you've always done well.
I think, like your first question about, how did I sort of get into rugby? Is when I was 21, my stepdad died, and then I realised like I was a larrikin in my late teens and early 20s, and then I realised if I was gonna try and make rugby. Because when he died, I thought, man, I really want to give this a crack.
Was he a rugby player?
Yeah, he wanted me to be a professional rugby. He wanted me to train hard. And I was just like pretending.
Mm.
So then that's when I started really talking to myself about, man, stop pretending. And every time I didn't want to go train, I was like, man, you got to work hard. And when I started being honest with myself and then I had success, I was like, that's probably the way to be.
Mm. So that wasn't till what, 21?
21, he passed away, and that's what inspired me to start training really hard. Yeah.
So what were you like before that? Were you a gifted player coming through the ranks?
I don't think I was gifted, like talented. I was just, my game was built on effort, tackling.
Even from a young age?
Yeah. Effort.
Yeah.
And later on, I was probably got a bit more skillful getting coached by good coaches and being around professional environments and Rangy and KK and playing sevens really helped me with my confidence. That was a big difference. My game was just effort, man.
Mm.
Yeah, effort and honesty with myself.
Yeah.
And then when I've ended up coaching, I try, and even as a captain in different teams, just be honest about things, and I think that's the way forward instead of no sugarcoating.
Yeah. So you were born in Wellington, is that right?
I was born in Palmy.
Palmy, that's right.
Yeah.
And then came down to Nelson. Schooled in Wellington.
Went to Upper Art College for 4 or 5 years in Wellington, and played first 15 there.
Yeah.
Had some really close friends that I still keep in contact with there. Good experience playing rugby at first 15, but we were sort of, I think, second div then. And then came back down to Nelson and played senior B's.
Yeah, crazy, yeah. And you were building at this stage, eh? Like, you were a builder for like 6 years before footy took over.
Started building at 18 and then built till I was 25. Yeah.
Not far out.
And that was a cool part of the club, is like, yeah, most people were studying like yourself or getting a trade, and then Tuesday, Thursday training, run around, play touch, and then do a bit of training and get ready for your club game in the weekend and give it everything for the boys and work really hard, and then have a good weekend, a few beers, and real sociable at that time in the club scenes. And I think that's something that I miss a lot. We were real successful here.
Yeah.
And we built a really good culture. And then as the, like, Tasman got made, then you had something to aspire to be.
Yeah.
Get a professional, but it took a lot of work, you know.
Yeah, I remember one pre-season in particular where you were on the frame, but you weren't quite getting the Tasman contract or anything. So you thought about a position switch. You were going to become a second five. This is what you'd planned. I remember going down to Botanics and you're practicing your wipers into the corner, shanking them everywhere. I was like, well, I'm not sure if second five is going to be your spot, but you're pretty keen on it. So talk me through that move and why you thought that.
I think it was Bevan that said maybe you should change to midfield, and there was Poffy and Zane Winslade and stuff at Tasman at the time, and I wasn't even making like the 34 man squad and then get cut when they cut the team down to 30, and I just wasn't good enough. I wasn't consistent enough, and I wasn't really big. Like, my frame was small, and I wasn't naturally that big, and that didn't help with my physicality and that. But yeah, I know looking back now, I wasn't good enough. I wasn't consistent enough. And then when I took it more seriously and made more sacrifice in my training and tried to understand the game a bit better, then I eventually made it. But it was a long process.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, eh?
Cause it was a mission, man.
And it was intense. I remember training with you a lot of those sessions, and we used to go pretty hard. Like, remember going into like the actual sides and thinking these sessions aren't as hard as some of those ones that we used to do. Like, we did used to train hard, and it was cool to see that you go through those ranks and get to where you got to eventually. But another move was when you went down to Buller, played sevens, or was it sevens or 15s as well?
It was sevens, and I played 15s too.
Yeah.
So that was a big change in my mindset.
Yeah.
So I think I'd worked really hard for 3 or 4 years and got cut a couple of years from that 30-man squad for Tasman. And then I was like, far out. I'm not going to make it. I just got to suck it up.
Had you given up on the rugby dream in your mind?
In my mind,
pretty
much,
yeah.
And
you're on the piss heaps.
Like I was a lad.
Yeah.
I loved it. It was cool, man. That's what I liked about the culture, you know. You could work really hard and then have fun, party with your mates and recover Sunday and do it again.
Yeah.
And the year before I went down to Buller, I was like, man, I see all these semi-pro people with the Marcos and the super teams. They were training all day. And I was slogging, working, man, you know, like, 8-9 hour days every day, and it's hard. You wake up at 6, go to the gym till 7, then go do a 9 hour shift, and then training after.
Yeah,
do that for 3 or 4 years. That's tough, and that's like Tane Robinson. He's done it with Craig Moore, working with Seymour Builders. Like, that's been tough.
Yeah,
but it builds your character because you know what hard work is. And then I did that for 3 years, trying to make it. Didn't make it, and then I thought, you know what, I'm going to quit work and give it a really good crack.
Yeah, that's right.
So I had a mortgage at the time, and I had a house, and I was a young dude. I was like 24. I thought, I'm going to take a 6 month like sabbatical off building and give it a really good crack.
Yeah.
So I put everything in, trained, tried to understand the game, got my body right, fit fast, and then I got dropped again.
True.
I was like, fuck.
Done.
Oh, I've had enough.
Yeah.
And then I realized, I went down to Buller. At the time of my life, I was working with Craig down there with his old man and Roscoe contractors and doing some building, and we were working 12-hour days building. And the people down in Reston work hard. So we were doing 12-hour shifts 4 days a week, sometimes 5 days a week, and then we'd go up to Westport, play in the weekend for Buller, and then go back down. Work another week, and I did that for 8 months, and then I played for Buller down in Queenstown in the Queenstown Sevens comp, and that, because I'd like let the dream of rugby go.
Yeah, took the pressure off.
Took the pressure off, bro, let it go to get more, and then I realised that, and which is what I really understand now, is rugby's more about the culture and the excitement of what the game brings.
Yeah.
It's not about trying to be a professional and then being an All Black. It's about, like, you can never play as well as you can when you're playing free and confident and just loving the game.
Yeah.
You're never going to be as good if you're not, if you don't have that mindset. And then after playing sevens for Buller, it helped me with confidence to run and tackle and be just confident with the ball. And I came up, played club the next year, and I was a completely different player because I'd let it go. And then I was able to play free, more carefree and with more confidence, and and then I finally made it.
Do you think that 6 month period where you did train hard helped as well, or was it a combination of both of them, or do you think it was mainly just the fact that you let it go?
Oh, it definitely would have helped with my body, like I'd built a bit more muscle and probably understood the game a bit more, and but mainly mental, more so mental, you know, like 6 months of trainer, you can lose that in a couple of months. It was mental, Jim. Like, I completely changed my mindset about what I thought. And I've, even at super level, like, for me playing super rugby, I needed to be really on to be good. Mm-hmm. And I need to sacrifice and do the right things in my preparation. If I didn't do that, I wasn't good enough to play consistently at a good level. But I think I still then I needed to take the pressure off mentally and then not worry too much about performance and enjoy the game more and the experience that I was having instead of being like, but I'm trying to play really good. And
yeah.
You see it all the time in young players, eh? We put too much pressure on ourselves, and I think that's maybe a lot to do with the culture and rugby in New Zealand.
Yeah, mate, that's fascinating. So then you do make Tasman. You don't play a huge amount that first year. You're behind a couple of like Poffies and stuff of the world. And then was it the following year you start getting a bit more of a crack? And you make New Zealand sevens, and you spoke about that earlier, but that being a bit of a game changer for you to give you that confidence that you were, I guess, good enough.
Yeah, it was. I never really got a real good crack at New Zealand sevens either. And again, that was another stepping stone where I tried to develop confidence at that level, but never really did. And then, so I played a couple seasons of Mitre 10, and I was getting skittled. Like, you think of Mitre 10 now, it's. you wouldn't think like it's a good level, but when I was playing it, I still wasn't good enough to play that level well.
Yeah.
And then I thought, shit, I've got to go to another level. So then one off season, I think it was I played sevens 2011, didn't really get much time for NZ and wasn't super confident at that level. But then in 2012 I came back, got cut from sevens, I think, and thought, man, I want to try and make super. And I knew that I needed to get my body bigger because I was like 91 kgs.
Oh, true.
Yeah, I was really light at the start of my career, and then I put on 12 kgs with a local guy, Brad Josie, helped me at results.
12 kgs, that's a
big... In an off-season, we used to just do three-hour sessions. And I remember just spending all my money on falafel. You know, falafel gourmet. Yeah.
That's why the owner knows you so well.
I was having two a day and thinking like I was eating cream rice, thinking it was good for me by the can.
When nutritionist told us cream rice was like the dream snack.
It's just sugar. And then the 6 months during that pre-season for club, I put on heaps of weight. So straight after the 2011 Mitre 10 Cup season, I was like, man, I'm going hard.
Yeah.
And I went hard for 6 months and I put on 12 kgs, and then I was way too heavy in club and I was basically walking everywhere, but I knew I was physical. I just couldn't sustain it.
Yeah.
And then that following year, leading into the 2013, I had a pretty good season.
On the balance.
Yeah, my body was bigger and I was actually always determined and I worked really hard. So that sort of filtered through maybe with my mindset in the 2012-2013 season when we did pretty well in the second div and then moved up and lost to Hughes in the final.
Well, I remember that game against Hawke's Bay. That would be one that probably stands out for you here at Tea Park, and close game. Go. Like Tasman had always been, you know, the battlers of the comp, really, and then to see them win that competition and in a game like that with the crowd, like right into Ehi West on that last kick, like some special memories for you.
That was a buzz, man, At the time I didn't realise, we knew it was massive, and I shared a video on my Facebook the other day. It was KK talking. It was like Sky Sport came down and interviewed him. He was a legend, man. You look back at the passion of the community on watching the Marcos then. There were thousands of people out at Tea Park. And that was probably a big reason why Ehi missed that kick. But we were battlers. Like, we were finishing second to last, third to last, right through to 2011. And then Rangi and KK sort of took the team, and we had a vision, and we were playing a real expansive attacking brand. And our philosophy was like, move the ball, get excited about our attacking brand, and inspire the town. You know, score tries, back yourself. And we managed to do that, and then grow our defense and our discipline and set piece. And we had a couple of good years, but we had a lot of support from the community. And it was like because we were coming up together as the club scene with the people that from the Marcos were playing club, and then we got successful in Tasman, and then those players, we ended up getting heaps of super players, and are now All Blacks, and it's like there's something that's missing there for the connection between our province and the club to keep that excitement in the community going. It's it's definitely sort of,
It's
I think it can be brought back.
And was it post that season you get signed to the Crusaders? I don't remember you being a Crusader, but
For 8 minutes.
Is that all you got?
Yeah.
So were you a full squad member?
Yeah,
true.
I think there was a season where Richie had a year off and was taking a sabbatical, and I jumped in, and Matt Todd was like the number one.
Yeah.
It was after the 2013 season when we did win that Hawke's Bay Championship final. I wasn't fit enough. I went down there pre-season. I realised, wow, I'm not fit enough.
Is this because you were too worried about putting size on?
I just wasn't. You know, you go from Tasman to your first super campaign and it's with the Crusaders.
Yeah.
They were fit and they were elite, and the training intensity was like it probably even more so now. But for me, I was just hanging around at club level and just didn't have the base for endurance, and didn't understand what it took like to back it up day to day. I didn't have that either, the day to day training. I didn't have that in my body, and I really struggled. But Matt Todd played awesome. He was a really good player, and I got an opportunity against the Force like round 7 or 8, and then 8 minutes in, man, popped my rib and I was done.
Did you start that game?
Yeah.
Oh, that's niggly, eh?
It was a buggy, yeah. It was a shame because I'd worked really hard to try and get an opportunity. Then I got injured straight away. And then that was it. Didn't get another crack, but then.
And that's tough, like, because you were an older athlete. How old were you at the time? Like 26?
27. 26.
Yeah, and to get 26. That crack and then have it taken away. How hard was that sort of injury at that bad time to deal with?
It was
just
frustrating. Yeah. It was a big step. Like, when you have these, I think, the development stages in your career and the time, it's way different than what you see now. But was it hard? It was frustrating.
Yeah.
Because if I'd been prepared and gotten fitter before I went down there, I could have handled it more.
Yeah.
And kept up better. I remember one of the first days of fitness testing, like we did a Bronco, and I did pretty good, and I think I beat Matt Todd by one. I thought, yeah, sweet, I'm all good. And then 15 minutes later we did this running thing. I just put everything I had into that. I think it was the beat test, bro. Yeah, and then I came in something like dead last in this 3K run or something. I was like, man, this is tough. I couldn't sustain the conditioning.
Yeah. Well, I could imagine you doing that, just going so hard in that one event.
They didn't tell me.
I'm competing here. Because you're a competitor, eh? Like, wanting, obviously, there, probably competing against Matt Todd, doing anything you can to beat him. He's probably knowing that he's got another 4-hour session coming up.
And he's been in it for like, the environment. That's why I think the development stages into professional rugby really helps. But if you don't go through that like I did, it's like you learn a lot fast, and it can probably be a little bit like costly if you don't understand what you need to put in.
Yeah. So what stopped you being a Crusader the following year? Was it just
Richie was back?
Oh yeah. So they got rid of you and Jamie Joe calls you.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
How did he sign you? I know he's quite good at signing players.
What happened there? No, he was all good. I played in the 2012 Maldives team.
Oh yeah. Under him. Yeah.
And I'd played pretty well, and I was already signed for the Satyrs the following year, and then we played the Highlanders in 2013 in Christchurch, and he came up to me in the changing sheds. He's the man, bro. The Crusaders just smashed the Highlanders, and he rolls and sits down. Oi, what up to next year?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, nothing, I'm not signed here. I'll be keen to come down. He's like, yeah, come down. And then, so I think I signed there for a couple of years, and I went away with the Maldives team again on 2013, and this is a funny story about Jake. I did my knee like the last play of a game. I think we were playing USA or something.
Oh,
did
yeah.
my knee, did a bit of damage, and I was going to be out for 3 or 4 months. And he rings me up and he goes, "How's the trip?" This was after the Maldives tournament. It was before preseason of the Landers 2014.
Yeah.
And I was like, "No, it was good. It was good. I enjoyed it, and you know, good experience traveling. And I've got this bad knee, and I'm probably going to be out for three months." And he loses it.
Yeah.
I'm like, "What are you talking about, man? Don't your doctors know? You know?
Yeah.
This isn't my fault." And that's where the communication between even the Maldives doctors and the Highlanders doctors, there was none.
True. It's crazy.
So I'm out for, I've got a contracted player that's out for 3 months with a buggered knee, and the coach doesn't even know. So these things in our rugby games are only just starting to develop, like the confidentiality clauses with players, medical stuff. That's good, but not with rugby players when they've got damaged knees or concussion.
Yeah.
It needs to, and I think it's better now. It's like clear transparency across the board, so everyone knows where a player's at. Back then, like Jake was nutting out saying,
"Nothing at you."
He's nutting at me like it's my fault. And I'm like, "Bruv, hang on."
Playing for my country. What was it like playing for the Maldives? Because
it was cool.
And you were obviously playing for them before you'd played Super.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Did you feel like comfortable in that environment, or did you feel intimidated?
No, it was really good. The 2012 season was just like, there was mainly, like, I think there was a few Super players, but mainly provincial players.
Oh, was it? Oh, yep. True.
That's where I met a lot of the boys from the Landers. Jared Hoyata really looked after me. He was a good fellow to me. I was like a new sort of dude. And, you know, I didn't feel the pressure there. It was different. It was like the Maldi teams that, that's a really nice thing about the Maldi team, is more of a, it's real family orientated, and it's just the, you try and build the culture before the professionalism of the game.
Mm.
And that's really important, I think, for all teams to understand. It doesn't have to be about Maldi, but the teams are actually about family and culture.
Yeah.
Instead of before you go and try and win a World Cup or provincial or Super. And you just do it. You just do it at the Crusaders really well. You can see it. It's obvious as. But a lot of teams don't do that. It's about player in, playing good.
Yeah.
He's in.
Yeah.
He's no good. He's out.
Yeah.
And that's where players, we sense that, eh?
Yeah.
Players sense that, and they won't give it everything. If everyone's not all in and you don't have that culture or the family sort of environment, you don't get the best out of everyone. And the Maldi teams, the first couple of years I was in it, Jake really brought that.
Mm.
That's I think one of his biggest assets is he's really empathetic for the players, whether you're playing well or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
He cares about the person more so about the rugby player, and he's honest.
Yeah.
And players can handle the honesty. I think that's what we forget. The players are honest to each other, and that's how you get the best out of each other. But as the higher you get up, I think the honesty goes out the door a little bit.
Mm.
I think I'll tell you a story about the Landers. This is a good one. When I went down there and when I was coaching, 6 weeks into the campaign of 2021 Highlanders season, I find out Brownie's leaving overseas halfway through the campaign.
Yeah, I remember that.
I lost it, Jim. I was so gutted.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, if Roger and whoever organised that had been really clear with me and the other coaches, the management, the players didn't know at the start, then there wouldn't have been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a problem for me because I've never been in a team and I've never wanted to be a part of a culture that isn't together. We're on the same direction, going in the same way everyone's in.
Yeah.
And that's how you can build something special.
Yeah.
Halfway through the season and then your head coach just leaves, bro. I was gutted and I was bitter. Everyone makes sacrifices to do things, and you just need to be clear and transparent from the start. And if you've got things like that that are going on in professional teams, they need to be open and honest with players, coaches, everyone.
Mm.
Otherwise you're going to end up having a disjointed team.
Mm.
And I love the Highlanders, but that's what it's been like for the last couple of years. So I'm so stoked to see Jamie go back there and hopefully revive them, and I'm sure he will.
Yeah. Well, he obviously did during your time there, because obviously I remember that 2015 final pretty well. On paper, I don't know if you guys felt the same, but that Hurricanes side was way better than your side. But
that's culture, man.
100% culture, and what you're talking about, that whole thing that everyone's playing for that same purpose, and you could see it, you could feel it out there.
Yeah,
guys were smoking me. Like, it felt like every time I'd carry, I'd get absolutely smoked, like so hard. I was like, far out. These guys are on.
Yeah, it was unreal. I had a hamstring season that year, and I only played the semi in the final. But the boys that really, really carried the team for the good group, the core group of players that were in the team consistently through that season, man, they had an awesome season. Mm-hmm. And it was cool to see and watch during the year, and then be a small part of it at the end was unreal. And they had their ups and downs. Like, I remember, I think it was the Waratahs, they got a hiding 55-10 or something, three or four games before the semis, so it wasn't all just smooth.
I remember the Hurricanes pumped, yeah.
Did you?
Must have been like a couple of games before as well, up in Hawke's Bay or Napier, and it was like, I think you guys rested a couple, but I remember that game because I was like, oh, Stoke, we're sort of playing these guys again in the final because we'd just beaten you by about 50 points and... going into that final thinking, oh, sweet. But no.
We had it like, we had good coaches.
Yeah.
Jamie, Brownie, Scott, Storm. They were super innovative for that time. Like the way we were playing. Brownie used to always talk about kicking stats and ball and play time.
Yeah.
Stormy was awesome with defensive, like tactical kicking and pressure plays. And Jamie was awesome around the set piece and being innovative at defence and attack with the mauling and different specials, and then our attitude was right, and it was sort of just come together in the last couple of weeks. And I guess like any team, you have to go through those hard weeks and learn to get better and come out the other side. And we had good players too, man.
Yeah.
They just hadn't been, like, they weren't showing.
Yeah, hadn't had their opportunity or...
yeah.
All coming with a little chip on their shoulder. I mean, like, Waisaki Naholos of the world, eh? Like, had a terrible time up at the Blues, got those opportunity down there. And
Malakai was the man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our backs were elite. Bucky.
Yeah, the buck truck.
He was the man. But our forward pack was really underdogs. Like, they were basically Mitre 10 Cup players.
Yeah.
And then to go physically against some of the better teams, it was cool. And that was all attitude. That's where Jake really got the best out of a lot of the players in that team. Yeah.
And obviously probably the number one question, I reckon it was like 90% of the questions that came in for you were post that 2015 final, like the celebrations. Obviously there was pictures of you and your kit for, I don't know how long you're in your kit for, but a decent amount of time. And talk to me about those celebrations.
4 days I was in my kit.
Was it?
Yeah. I don't know what come over. I was just like, this is so good. I'm not taking off my jersey. There's no way. I can't believe it. I think about back now, I was like a club player for 7 years.
Yeah.
Grinded it out doing a trade and playing club.
Yeah.
And then a couple of years later, I'm in a super final. I'm not taking my jersey off. No way. And that was so cool to experience that. What a buzz. And I was just a small part of it. And to be around the players that you're with and to do what we did against a team like you guys had, you were awesome players and had been for a long time. Some of the legends of our game in our country. And the do was like all night in Wellington, still running around with my boots the next morning.
Yeah.
I think I got told by the manager to put some shoes on.
were you supposed to fly out with the Maldives that night?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is another thing about culture. We can, hopefully you got some time. I want to talk about
something. Let's go, man.
So, like, that was a real interesting experience for me because I had been so, because I think my character and I really want to, I want to experience winning a Super Rugby final. And spend time with your family and the friends that you did it with. Well, I think the next day the Māori team was supposed to go overseas.
Yeah.
And when I'd sort of heard that we can't even have a couple of days to experience that with the team, and there was six or seven of us, and we were like, man, this is nuts. You know, you just put yourself through this eight-month, pretty intense campaign, have an amazing experience and enjoy it. And then the professionalism of rugby says go away 24 hours later to the next campaign. It's like, that's so far away from a positive culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't, I couldn't believe it. And I tried to speak to a few of the boys and I'll say, maybe we can organise with the Maltese coaches just to go 2 or 3 days later. It was like, nah, mm-hmm. there was no reason for us to go. They had like a game 8-10 days later and, you know, just roll in a couple of days late.
Mm.
That's where I think commercialism's taken over our game, and it's been detrimental to the game and to the players, because you can see it in the performances and the campaign, and the campaigns at super level, the All Blacks, and even our spectatorship. You know, if a community in the rugby culture isn't thriving, both spectators and players, because of the pressure maybe being too much, it's because of things like that, like the expectation to move on so fast from something you've just given your life to.
Yeah.
It's irresponsible, I honestly think it is, because you get the best out of, like that story I said, when you drop the pressure and enjoy what the game is, then you can get the best out of it.
So you're in that celebration. I think it was in Kurt Baker's episode. He was supposed to fly it as well, and he remembers you sort of holding a meeting with those guys and saying, come on, guys, let's stay. You obviously stayed. You didn't go on that flight.
No. I had a niggly hamstring, and I was going to be like, my hamstring was buggered, and I could have gone and then tried to grind it out, but I could have been at risk of buggering it even further.
Yeah.
So my doctor said that it might not be a good idea if you go straight into a campaign you've just drunk for 3 days
or, yeah.
you know, 2 days, and then you're going to go to a Maltese game. You might cause more damage. I spoke to the boys and I said, hey, like, there's six of us. Let's just say, like, let's connect with the manager and the Maltese team, and we'll try and see if we can go back a couple of days late. And they said no. And then I was like, well, my hamstring's not 100 anyway. I can probably say that I'm going to stay with the boys, and that's the way it is. But an interesting thing with that, I had a phone call from someone at New Zealand Rugby, and they said, hey, what's up? You're not coming to the Maltese tournament? I said, yeah, my hamstring's not that good. And I said, hey, we should be going a couple of days later. And they said, well, this is the campaign schedule. As a player, contracted player for New Zealand Rugby, you have to meet these schedule requirements, and we could send you to some sort of disciplinary board about not going. And that was my introduction to the professionalism of our country's game. And I've always seen it, and now I see it more, because you look at the community game and the provincial game, it's not going well. And it's because we've been overrun by these high expectations to go week to week, month to month. And it's, like I said, it's detrimental to the player and the communities around with supporters and stuff. So I didn't end up going away on that Maltese trip, and I had, you know, the best 5 days of my life. I'll never, ever forget that. And to sit back and experience it, like, I think we had a five-hour lock-in in the Mornington Tavern. It was out of control. I remember crying for about an hour.
Did you?
Yeah.
Because of what? Just happiness.
Just so happy, man.
Couldn't believe you're getting calls from NZIO.
Oh, no, that was just like a thing that I'll never forget, and it's made me a bit more aware of what happens in a professional sport. And I understand, man, we've got to be professional and get the best out of the players, but I think it's gone too far. And that was a good example for me to see it firsthand, that, what, disciplinary board? What?
Yeah.
That's not a thing. It's not a thing, Jim. And of course you want to do the best by each team you're in.
Yeah.
But they just absolutely, they like degraded what you've just been through.
Mm.
And first ever, the Highlanders are still celebrating that win for 8 years on. You know? You're going to say, I'm going to go 2 days later.
Yeah.
And the boys that didn't experience that, do, you know, they were more so part of that team than I was, and they had to go to a campaign. And no one remembers those moulded tournaments, you know, at that time for those players. Of course, it's an amazing privilege to be a part of a Maldives team. But what's 3 days for a player? Yeah. What's 3 or 4 days? You know, it's not right with that, situation. And I hate to see it happening in our rugby culture.
Yeah. No, good on
you. Well, you got to have something. You got to stand on something.
Yeah.
You got to have good, solid morals. And for me, that's the most important thing to me. I'm not always right, man. I'm wrong about exit.
Do you reckon it cost you playing for the All Blacks?
I just wasn't good enough.
You reckon?
Yeah, no.
Because I reckon that following year, I don't know if it was the following year, but you were next level, like you were pushing it.
I think the 2014 year I went to a camp for the All Blacks. I think Toddy was out and Richie might have been injured. And like, I look back at that time and I was still all effort.
Yeah.
I didn't even know the game, Jim. Yeah. I really only learnt the game when I started coaching.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at detail and with detail. And it would have been awesome to be an All Black. I always dreamed of being an All Black. How cool. But I think you could, if you were lucky enough to get an opportunity through injury, that may have happened for me, but I just wasn't. And then I wasn't consistent enough. Like at Super, I worked hard, but I wasn't always playing consistent. And like I said, I need to be at my best every week to play well. And if I wasn't at my best, I just didn't always play the best. So it was like,
So then how did it all end for you? Like, we've spoken about your concussions, and what was the final blow, and when did you know that was it?
My last game was 2016 for the Maldives.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd had multiple head knocks, and every clean out, every tackle, I was getting ringers, like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Little knocks, and I was thinking, man, this isn't good. And then I think in that game, I you do like a couple tackles against the pad before the game.
Yeah.
I can't remember who was holding the pad, but I hit his elbow, and it was just like both pressure in my head, and I'd had these issues. Then I played 30-40 minutes into the game, and I was like, man, I'm not right, and I just walked myself off.
Good, yeah.
And then I remember sitting in the changing room, and the doctor came up to me, and I was like, man, my neck's not right. And he tried to do the HIA test, and I was like, don't worry about it, it's my neck. And then I couldn't really see that I'd had concussion problems for months, and then that was it. And I tried really hard to come back, like 3 or 4 months. I went hard, did all the return to play protocols, just gradually didn't overdo it. But when I got to 80-90%, I was getting sharp pains in my head. Like, the running intensity was what was getting me. I could do weights reasonably well, but when I was doing high running intensity stuff, it was no good. And then 6 months after trying to return to play, I finished. And you know, even with the way that I finished with concussion, I remember reading an article in the media up in here, and I was with the Tasman team in 2017, and it was like the mysterious case of Shane Christian. And I was like, that's really frustrating, man.
Yeah, a few questions came in about it, like what was this mysterious illness and stuff, and I was like, it's crazy that it was portrayed like that.
Yeah, it's really crazy. And I think there was a few people that had been finishing around that time, and to me at that stage I really thought that they didn't want it to be in the mainstream.
So weird.
Well, it's disheartening for a player that's just, you know, given everything to a sport and had concussion problems and consecutive head knocks, and then the media comes out saying that, saying some sort of mysterious cases. Like, hey, let's just be honest about what's happening. Like, people get head knocks, and if it's not really carefully looked after, you have to finish.
Yeah.
Even a disappointing thing was I'd done these return to play protocols carefully and gradually, and I kept on failing after 3 months. And then in my mind, I'd known that I'd had multiple head knocks and I wanted to retire. And I didn't see a specialist for concussion for 9 months from the start of my issues at the Landers.
9 months?
9 months later is when I seen a specialist. And I had to ring New Zealand Players Association, Rob Nicol. I had to ring him and say, hey, man, I need to get an appointment with the specialist. Because, you know, GPs and they're not specialists.
Nah.
That's crazy.
So the idea to delay the inevitable for me was incredibly frustrating. It was hard, and I thought, man, what's going on? This is what's happening. I've been open and honest with my doctors about everything. Mm. This is what it looks like. This is the, like, I had records of having concussion problems in Tasman, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think that we're just not quite, we don't have it quite right around our medical system and the honesty, transparency around concussion in New Zealand rugby. And I think if we get things right with the transparency, categorising and making sure that we have each and every concussion filed for each player through the grades, and then make more awareness around concussion. So in Spain, Fozzy was telling me that they make all the age grade players wear headgear.
Mm.
And we know headgear doesn't do nothing.
That cracks me up, eh? People are like, wear headgear to help your concussion, or like someone who's struggling with concussion then wears headgear the next week.
That still happens, eh?
It does still happen.
Yeah, I was going to say a player that, yeah, but I mean, you know, it might help with confidence. And it helps with scratches or whatever. But it's not going to stop a, you know, head against a forearm or a knee.
Yeah. And when you did finish, when you made that final call that, yeah, you're not going to play again, how hard was that? What did you miss the game? Did you know what you were going to do because it was taken away from you so quickly? To building?
No, I was buggered, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was buggered. I was worried about getting day-to-day.
Really?
Yeah, I was bad. I was super bad. And like I said, that six-month period where I couldn't get clarity around my, like, I needed to speak to someone and get some confidence around what does concussion look like?
Mm.
How long am I going to be buggered for? Where am I with my symptoms? How come I can't run past 80%? Those sorts of questions weren't really answered. And that's stressful.
Mm.
So for you know, a year I was pretty stressed out and really uncertain. I come up to Tasman in 2017 and I hung around with the team like I was pretty crazy. I still thought I was a player. I could probably tell you some stories about that.
Go on, then.
I remember we had some new coaches, Leo Crowley. He would have a laugh about this, I think.
Yeah.
He was doing.
He's a good man.
He's a good man. He's done really well with Wellington last year, and he was doing the D, and I was frustrated as because we weren't that good and we were struggling away. We actually ended up making the semi, I think, that year. Or no, we made the final, but we got spanked by Canterbury, and we had a young team.
Oh yeah,
you know, really young, and we did really well, but I was nutting out, and I'd go up to the office and say, this is what I think's happening, and you're not doing this, you're not doing that.
Yeah.
And we're having big arguments. And the other thing around me then is, like, when you've got issues with frustration and you've got concussion problems, you can be quite, you know, abrupt.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was definitely that.
Is this how you got into coaching? Because like you said, you weren't really thinking of the game technically, tactically as a player. So is it when this transition happened, you're up in the office telling everyone what to do, everyone's just like, mate, may as well sign you because you're saying all the right stuff.
Nah, I think Rennie looked after me, you know.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he'd had concussion and he looked after me and he was really good. And but I remember texting Ray, like I'd pretended I knew what I was talking about in that year when I was still a player, and
yeah,
I said to Ring at the end of the season, man, can I get a job coaching? I want to do the D next year. And then it was just text.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, I'll talk to the other coaches and the board and see what happens. And then I was like, no, I need to know now. And he said, what, you want me to tell you over text right now? And I was like, basically, just thought I was crazy.
But you got it.
But I was crazy. And I did get it. But that's what I'm like, I guess, and it's probably been, it's a good and a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I was lucky at that time that Rang really looked after me, because even that following year in 2018, I was still pretty buggered, you know. I'd try and understand the game at a different level so I could help coach with the boys and then deal with my concussion symptoms, like anxiety, getting up in front of a squad of 30 when you don't even know what you're talking about, bro.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah.
And I used to do some funny things, like bring in axes and try and give the boys, like, you know, big packs of chops and stuff,
yeah,
best tackler, and come up with different things. And it was fun, but I really respect for how Rainey helped me and showed me a lot about D and the game and coaching, and understood that I probably wasn't that good with my head. And they just, like, gradually helped me. And Goody was there at that time, and he was a big hand with helping me with different things. So I was lucky to get in coaching through Tasman.
Yeah,
I don't think a lot of places may have said they wouldn't have given me the chance. Even Tony Lewis, when he was here, he put up with me for a few years. Like, I went from playing to coaching after a concussion. I was still thinking I was a player for a couple of years. Yeah.
What do you think you would have done if they didn't pick you up?
I just would have went somewhere else. Undecided coach. That I wanted to coach. Oh, yeah, yeah. Talking to
Ash. Once you get something in your mind, mate, you're going to do it.
I was talking to Ash, and I was good mates with Ash at that time, and I was still good mates with him. But I was like, bro, who's your D coach next year for the Bay? Like, I might as well come up there, you know?
Yeah.
I just wanted to coach. I like the environment. I love the culture, and I thought I could help. And if I could learn and get an opportunity somewhere, then I might be able to do it. So,
what didn't you love about coaching?
Not getting my own way.
Mm.
Yeah. Because I'm stubborn, I think that I'd want to do things the way I want to do it. And I think that I'm right until I get proven wrong. That's a funny way to be, Jim.
Yeah.
Because you need someone that you're challenging to be really clear.
Yeah.
And calm, so they can tell you quickly, and you're like, oh, yeah, no, I'm wrong. It's all good, bro. I'll carry on. But if they're not clear and calm, and then they get angry, it's like, fuck, we're going to have an argument, damn it. Like, far out.
I always remember you being really calm and clear as a coach. Like, when people would challenge you, you'd always be real calm, honest, and never really look like you got too rattled.
It's not, definitely, quite often it wasn't how I was feeling.
Was it?
Yeah, and I used to have to think about it a lot. Like, I'd try and, like, I got bad anxiety, bro.
Yeah, I didn't ever notice that either. Like, you always looked so confident, and you've always been one of those guys who can say whatever. It always felt like you'd just say whatever. You'd go into a shop and tell them what's the cheapest price they could give you. Like, not many people go and do that. Like, you just always looked like you had no sort of fear or anything with that. But to hear that you had anxiety in those meetings and stuff was interesting.
It was crazy. I never had anxiety until I had my concussion.
Oh, yeah.
And then when that happened, and then it would come and go depending on how my head was.
Mm.
Like, if I hadn't been sleeping well, or if I'd been on the computer too much, that really got me, you know?
Yeah.
And then I'd start getting anxious. And then what I did know is that it was just temporary. And then if I could just get myself through it, it would pass.
Mm.
But I had to sacrifice myself for the boys, basically, you know, like, if I wasn't honest with myself and just like, it's all good, man, this is just invisible, it's your mind, and people here care for me. And I had I trusted a lot of the coaches and the players. They really looked after me, like the senior boys that I played with, Druza and Davey and like all those boys, I knew that they had my back, and I knew I wasn't perfect. But they knew I meant well, and I cared, and I wanted them to be good, and I wanted us to be successful. And I think that's what gave me the confidence to get through that without stressing out about it too much.
Mm.
So you just got to, for me anyway, I just put myself out there, and I know I'm not perfect. No one is, but anxiety is an interesting thing, like, because I know it comes and goes. I know it's just temporary. And ice bathing's really good for it.
Is that the best thing for it?
Yeah.
Wow.
100%, yeah.
Is that instant, or is that something that has a longer effect?
You got to do it after multiple days, but it does something to, like, suppress your nervous system. So if your nervous system's really wound up, like I was at the Landers, then you're operating on a different energy, man. It's like it's real like a gnarly, wired up sort of energy, and you can function on it fine for months. And you don't have to sleep that much, and you're basically fine. But when you calm down and you get back to normal life, it's like, whoa, I'm beat up. Yeah, where normally you just sleep, eat healthy, rest and recover, and you're normally happy and stuff.
Yeah.
When you're operating on a weird nervous system. It's just like you're wired all the time.
I do love a good ice bath, but what were you doing 15 minutes?
Yeah. So like July last year, I was like straight away, I knew I had to do ice bathing. And I was just doing 2 or 3 minute cold showers morning and night. And when that was easy, I got an ice chest freezer. And then I started out just a couple minutes, 3 or 4 times a day. And then, because I wanted to be healthy and I need to get my energy way up so then I don't come back down quick. And then just started 10 minutes, 3 times a day. 15 minutes, 3 times a day. So more and more. And then, like, I'll get back and I'll get my, I'll tell you a story about a 2 week period. And it wasn't that long ago. Where I'd been real stressed and my concussion was having issues and I was having real foggy and headaches often, and I started getting real paranoid. And I think this is something that Billy may have experienced as well, man, because in these moments of paranoia, it's not really you. And I didn't see it at the time, but I was having these paranoid moments thinking I'd misplaced someone, something, and someone had stolen something from me and someone had come into my house and robbed me. And I just, because I wasn't thinking clear enough, I couldn't see the reality. And then when you go through these sort of manic stages and when you come out of them, you got pressure in your head because you just put your body through this pressure. Well, if that happened to me 3 or 4 times over a 2 week period, and then it just wipes me out for 3 or 4 days, and then I'm bang back to square one with my head, and I've got to be in bed and I've got to do all the right things to recover. And then that's because, like, stress, too much workload, having issues with your cognitive problems, and then keep on pushing yourself, then you definitely start losing your ability to think clearly. And then the putting paranoia on top of that, it can be really, really hard. And it's not easy to come out of these things. And I think experiencing that recently.
Was that the first time you'd experienced it, paranoia?
Nah.
You'd had that.
I had it earlier in my, like, couple years after the concussion, but during the worst stages. So 2018, I started my first year with coaching for Tassie. And then I'd do the Tassie season. It'd spend the next sort of 6 months recovering. And I was helping with the, so I was contracted for Tasman for the 3 months in the season, and then I'd do a little bit of community stuff in the off season. But that off season, I was buggered. You know, I was like tired, bro. And it would take months to come right for the Tasman season. So that was 3 years. And during that time, I had paranoid moments where I'd misplace something, or I'd misinterpret a friend and have a crack at them and then push them away because I think, man, you're playing up. But it's really because I couldn't really see things that clearly. And then I'll tell you a story about when I was bad after the 2019 season. We won and it was an unreal season. I think it was our first premiership victory. Who was that against? A Wellington out here.
Oh, yeah.
I went out, had a couple of beers with the boys. The next day I was wiped out.
And you wouldn't usually drink, eh?
No, I wasn't drinking, but like staying up all night, that's tough for me.
Would wreck you,
And then like a couple of beers, like literally a few beers and that's it. And then the next day I was buggered, bro. Like felt like I was on a boat, spewed during the day. And I was like, man, I've got to, right, the season's gone. We're up really high and functioning on that like super anxious type of energy that it's hard to understand, but my nervous system had been buggered. And then when you come down and then you're by yourself trying to recover, and then that's when I started having issues with paranoia and stuff. And then going through the recovery stage with my head, but it's not really that clear. And then I was doing all the right things, cold therapy. This is only a couple of weeks after the 2019 season. Every day, and I was seeing a psychologist about just hanging on, keeping it together. And then for a couple months, every day I was walking in Isle Park, and my head was so bad, man, that I'd walk past trees and I'd see myself hanging from it.
What, an image, like a visual image?
Visual image, and then I knew that my head wasn't right.
Far out.
Yep. And that happened for, you know, a good month. And I'd spoken to a psychologist about it, and that's how bad my concussion was. And that's, I was coaching full time. But the fatigue that the season had on me, and the fatigue that the season had on me, it's like when you lose the energy and you lose your battery, and then you're operating down here.
Yeah,
it takes a long time to get back.
Yeah,
but as you're trying to come back, you're trying to get your head right.
Yeah,
and on the way up, your head's not functioning that clearly, you know. Yeah. And then you're thinking things and you're doing things and saying things that aren't yourself. And I understood that then, that I wasn't in a good place.
Mm.
And I'd looked into things like hallucinogenic drugs overseas, MDMA, you know, the stuff that was on the news the other day on the Ranfurly Shield.
Yeah.
Well, they use that for, like, therapy in the States for different mental conditions, and they can use it for concussion conditions to rewire, like, your neurological pathways. There's MDMA therapy, psilocybin therapy, ayahuasca, ibogaine. These things that actually help your mind to maybe see a different perspective or change the wires in your mind.
Have you done those?
I did. When I went after that really, really bad stage, after the 2019 campaign, I knew I was bad, bro, and I was like, man, I've got to go and try and get into something like this, because the care that I was getting from, like, ACC and in New Zealand, we don't have that in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
It's just antidepressants. And if you're having problems sleeping, take some sleeping pills. You're not going to get out of a really, really dark hole if you've had concussion and that's what you're going to get given. And, like, my family understood what I was going through, but I didn't have a partner, so I was by myself. You know, you're really, really isolated when you've got concussion. I was like, if I'm going to get out of this, I'm going to go and try this stuff, because it's – and I'd done heaps of research. And I'd spoken to a specialist here outside of New Zealand Rugby and ACC that said you can probably do the psilocybin therapy, which is like mushrooms.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not just take a few mushrooms. It's like medical grade stuff, even the MDMA.
Yeah.
It's medical grade stuff. And then they give you therapy while you're under the influence of it. And we had that trip to the States. We played a couple development teams over there for the young boys.
Right. Yeah.
So I was going to help Gray with that team, and I'd had this problem leading up to that, and I was like, Gray, shit, I can't be involved in this team, but I want to come, and I can help when we get over there, but I've got to get my health right.
Mm-hmm.
So basically I was like, see you at the airport, bro. And I'd trained for, you know, 6 weeks beforehand, and I was struggling, man. Every day was a grind. And I went and helped out. It was really cool to be a part of that young group, and like some Braden Stewart and Tane was in that team. All the young boys that are out there now. And then after the comp, I started going around the States trying to get this therapy, and I'd rung specialists, and I was talking to a specialist through NFL over there.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. I'd spent thousands of dollars, bro. It was expensive, and they had a lot more treatment that was possible, like this laser treatment stuff that you can put in your nose, your ears, and there's a guy, Tim Ewer, over in Mapua, I think he does things like that in the hyperbolic chambers, oxygen that you can take. But ACC doesn't cover that sort of treatment. So I couldn't get in to do the EMDA and the psilocybin therapy, because you have to do like 3 or 4 sessions and then stay for a couple of weeks and then do them sort of over a 3-month period, and it was expensive in the States. After the trip with the boys, I was living in hotels, like just going from hotel to hotel, but it wasn't like a holiday. I was still really, really worn out and fatigued, and it was like I'd wake up in the morning, go for a wander around, get back home to my hotel and sleep in the afternoon, go back out, have a feed, and go back home early. That was my trip, yeah. And I was trying to get a break away from NZ, get away from the New Zealand rugby scene, and then get my health right, and I was looking for this therapy. Well, I ended up going down to Mexico and then taking ayahuasca 3 times. And that was probably one of the hardest things I've done.
Really?
Ayahuasca is like this root plant that's a really, really strong hallucinogenic trip.
Yeah.
And I did that 3 times and the experience was wild, man.
What happens?
The first time... So you've got a shaman and you can do it as a group.
Yeah.
And but I wanted to do it by myself because it's like a private thing. I really need to get this thing under control because I'd lost sort of like my mind wasn't playing the game anymore. It was a little bit out of control. And I'd known that rewiring your mind can... It can be possible with these drugs. And the first time the shaman was around me and like playing music and they're like, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. They lead you in and out of this trip. And the drug showed me this, it's like a story that maybe all of us think about. What is, why are we here? What's our purpose? What's the meaning of life? And it just, I'd crack up laughing. And then I'd try and think, and then something would come to me like a thought. And it'd be trying to tell me it, and then I'd just miss it. And I was like, what is that? What just happened? I'm trying to understand what happened. And then I'd crack up laughing again. And I'd try to pick exactly what's coming into my mind.
Yeah.
And this went on for about an hour and a half, the same sort of routine. And after the next day, I realized the first trip, the experience that the drug was trying to show me was just that life was more like experience, and then you take what you learn from that experience and implement it into the next like activity or the next goal in your life, and then you learn again and you go back to start, experience, take your learnings, implement it into the next goal, learn again, and then go back to the start. And that seems real simple, but for me, it just gave me like a more of a understanding of there's no real pressure on me. This is, I guess I can just go through this slowly. I'm going to learn. It's going to be stop, start. I'm going to, it took a lot of the pressure off of trying to come right. The second time I took it, I went in there with an intention of trying to get something out of it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't good. It kicked my ass and I ended up spewing and you get really bad diarrhea. And
what was your intention?
It was stuff that I wanted to get sorted with my family.
Oh, okay.
Before I went over there, I'd had this big barney with my brother-in-law.
Oh, yeah.
And my sister, and we were having like just normal family stuff. And that was like I was really hurting from that. And I still haven't spoken to him. And maybe after this I will.
Yeah.
But
he's listening.
Yeah, no, maybe. But with ayahuasca, you don't want to go in there and think you're the boss.
Yeah.
It just dominated me.
All right, that's crazy.
It made me really, really crook, and I was violently spewing, and this went on for 6 or 7 hours, and then it takes days to recover from this thing too. So, and I didn't really get deep into the trip. I did the first 2 sessions over a week period. The first one was really good because I felt like it taught me something about life, just the process. And then the second one, I tried to go in there and get something from it, but it didn't work. And then the third one, I was like, right, I'll do it again in 6 weeks. I just ate green vegetables, no coffee, no alcohol, no weed or anything. And I was just chilling in Mexico. And the last time I got it, the guy said, hey, man, you can take like a couple different portions. This is really, really strong. Or you could just have this one. It's sort of similar to what you were having. And I took the strong portion. It was maybe 3 or 4 times as much as I'd had the first 2 times.
Jeez, even though you had that reaction after the second time.
Yeah, because I knew this was bad, Jim. Yeah. You're walking around Isle Park thinking that, you know, seeing these visions. It was serious for me, man, because I was at a stage where if I'm going to come out of this and not do anything crazy to myself and try and fix myself, this is the way I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So I'd done a lot of fasting and dieting for 6 weeks up to the time I did it, and we went into lockdown in Mexico.
Oh, that's right. You're stuck over there, weren't you?
Yeah, I was stuck over there, and then I was in like this 40-person Airbnb hostel place, and everyone left, And the Argentinian dude that was the manager,
yeah.
I got on with him well. And he was like, bro, look after the cats. This is you. I'm off home. And I was in this little beach town that no one was there. You know, it was a really chill place. And I was like, I'm going hard. I'm going to get my shit together and take this drug and hope like hell it can get my brain rewired.
Yeah.
And during that 6 week period where I was, have I ever spoken to
him? No, this is all new now.
During that 6 week period where I was dieting hard out, and I was trying to exercise, like I was doing a bit of surfing and walking and heaps of yoga. I was doing a hell of, like a lot of yoga, man.
Yeah.
And then, but I was also watching, there's this documentary on, Netflix is like World War II in colour. And bro, I watched every single episode over this 6 week period, and man, I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
That was really interesting to see what happened back then in the 40s, bro. That's why I post what I'm talking about on social media at the moment.
Yeah.
So I watched that. And I was preparing to do this ayahuasca, and he gave me this really intense potion. And I was like, man, I'm taking the whole thing, and I'm locking myself in my room in the dorm, and no one was there.
Oh, you're by yourself?
By myself in this hostel, yeah. By myself. So the thing with the ayahuasca is maybe 40 minutes or an hour after you first ingest it, you purge.
Mm.
So it comes into your digestive system, and then you spew it back out, and then you go into the trip. Well, I took it by myself. And I'd had three or four times more than I'd had previously. And then I ended up falling asleep. Like I put on this YouTube video of like the shaman music, which is awesome. It sort of leads you, guides you through the trip. And it was an hour and a half later, and I'd sort of just woken up from asleep, and I heard this massive crack, like it was thunder and a real loud lightning bolt. And I was like, whoa, that's out of it. What was that? And it was my stomach.
Oh.
And it was an hour and a half later. I looked at the time and I was like, whoa, this is going to be gnarly. Normally you purge after about 30, 40 minutes, and it was an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And I'd fallen to sleep. And then the crack of the noise was like, shit, it's about to kick in. And I sat up on the edge of the bed like this, and I was a different person.
What do you mean a different person?
I was in Auschwitz prisoner. So my body was like just bone.
What, like skeleton?
Yeah, like I had still, I just had no muscle on me.
Oh, just skin like on bone.
Imagine a prisoner.
Yeah, okay.
In the Nazi camps, that's, you know, that tragic time, man. Well, that's because I'd been watching all these,
yeah,
this documentary, and then my mind had taken me to this space where I'd become a prisoner, and I broke down crying, and I was on the edge of the bed, and I was like, shit, this isn't good. And I knew I was still Shane, I was still me, my body and my eyes were like showing me something different.
Mm.
And then I went into the bathroom, which was just in front of me, and I looked at the mirror, and I was like, whoa, like the hallucinogenic strong, bro. And I was the same person, but my body had lost all the flesh in it, and I was just bone. Like, you imagine some of the videos, yeah, you would have seen of that time, and that's what I'd been watching, and that's what I became. And I just fell on the ground and started crying, bawling my eyes out, and then spewed up, and then for the next hour and a half tried to deal with it mentally.
Far out.
Yeah. And I thought, it was like, people talk about having past life regressions and experiencing something that you may have already been and come to a new life as this.
Mm.
But it was just because I'd put so much time into learning about what had happened. But what that taught me was the appreciation of what I've got.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you see and feel that, and it wasn't just the physical trip, it's the emotional trip that you get with,
yeah,
ayahuasca. It changes your whole consciousness.
All right.
Like, yeah, it was intense, and it was like an appreciation afterwards that I knew that even though I'd had concussion, and this is how the drug seems to work, like, even though I'd had concussion and I was really struggling and maybe being a bit suicidal and lost those times where I seen visions and lost a little bit of a track in my head, if I could get through that we are fortunate to be here.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I still feel lucky. And then it just, after that, even though it took me a long time, it took me a couple months to recover from the trip because it's actually hard on your mind. I really, really changed after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, completely. I came back from overseas. It took me a couple months to get my energy back. And then I had this new appreciation of what my life was. And even though I still get concussion problems, I've just got a way deeper understanding of how fortunate I am, even though I went through that.
Yeah, that's cool.
It is incredibly cool, man. And because that's all it is. Mm. It's your perspective.
Yeah.
And that's what that drug taught me, is that, yeah, I've had a couple head knocks, but it's not the end of it.
Yeah.
You know, you can grind through stuff. And you can get better, and you can look for different treatment. And no matter what happens, I'm still luckier than a lot of people that are bloody unfortunate at the moment.
Mm.
So you can't get that sort of treatment from anything in New Zealand, you know?
Mm.
And I don't know, like, the core details about how it changes your brain, but they don't have treatments like that for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
These sort of drugs have been in civilizations for thousands of years, and even doing MDMA in a therapy session, that's something that we could try and investigate for people that have ongoing concussion problems. And the psilocybin stuff, it's not just a mushroom under a plant where people trip out and look at the stars.
Yeah.
This stuff can actually be super helpful because it just needs to change the way you're thinking and give you a bit more strength and perspective like it did for me.
Mm. What you went through, like, you obviously put a huge amount into getting right. Like, you invested a heap into your mind to get it right. And I guess that's where a lot of guys don't do it. You know, they sort of don't give up, but they just don't invest what you have done into your mind. And is that where it all goes wrong? Like, you've obviously done really well to get your head into the space it is now, and still have your probably issues, but you've had it made a huge commitment to get your mind back on track.
Mm. What drives me, I suppose? Well, doing that drug, man.
Yeah.
Like, you think about 3 years, I was really beat up. And then after that season, I was probably the most happiest ever been. That's still the ring.
You're on fire that year.
No, that was a special time. And then even after that, I just went bang down and then struggling. And then I knew that was the worst I've ever been.
Mm.
Like, to have those visions, and consistently it was going on every time I'd take this dude for a walk.
Yeah.
And I just knew that if I didn't do something drastic and I didn't do it for me, I was going to end up really bad.
Mm.
And that's something that I was pretty fortunate to come across, and I did get the right help, and I spoke to a specialist, and she said, this is probably going to be really hard for you. You're probably better to do the psilocybin one or MDMA, but this can work for people with concussion. You don't get told that from a lot of places, with maybe around the New Zealand rugby format with ACC and stuff.
Yeah.
It was like a holistic specialist that I went and seen, and that gave me the confidence that what I was reading online and seeing these experiences of people that have done it can change. Like, people that have bad drug addictions go overseas and do the Ibogaine, and it snaps them out of a really bad heroin addiction. Like, the worst, bro. So it can change your mind, these types of drugs, and for me it helped a lot. And it's not that I'm back and it didn't fix me, but it gave me a better perspective. And then after that, I went into the 2020 campaign with the Marcos again, and we managed to win again up at the Blues.
Yeah.
And I'd been talking to the Landers, and then thinking, man, if I'm around the boys, I'm gonna be all right.
Yeah.
So I would have struggled, you know. It was gonna be tough doing the Landers season. I know they supported me heaps.
Yeah.
The coaches, Brownie, supported me, and they were, like, looked after me heaps as well as they could. And Dermo was really good. But being in the environment like that and trying to get that professional career going on, it was hard on me, but it's better to be in that environment in a supportive group than by myself when you can, you know, put yourself in a hole.
Yeah.
So that's really why I got into that full-time role with the Landers. Mm. But I think what gave me the confidence and the motivation to do it was the ayahuasca trip, 100%. I wish Billy could do that, man, yeah. But it cost me money.
Mm.
Like it was thousands of dollars.
So I mean, it's a big investment into your
investment,
own.
Yeah. And that aspect, like the financial thing, ACC doesn't pay for those types of things. They'll just think you're a loony, bro.
Yeah.
But I had to do that because otherwise, you know, how bad was it going to be? And I think if Billy could have that support, and if I'd know what I know now, I would have just said, bro, go do this. I'll come with you and I'll pay for it.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing that he had wrong with him that we couldn't have fixed.
Mm.
And, yeah, why I did it, because it was that bad, Jim.
Yeah.
Ozil Park wasn't a good experience for me.
Willing to do anything.
Yeah, and it was simple as that. I was bad. Mate, but it got me here.
It's 100%, here, right, yeah. And willing to share enough.
So I'm comfortable. I was never going to share this. And, you know, I told Goody 2 months ago that's how bad I was after that 2019 season. It was only because of Bill passing that I've seen, like, man, I've got to say some shit.
Yeah, because, I mean, I've been trying to get you on this thing for probably 3 years since I started. Like, I've always loved your rugby journey, just the rugby journey itself, but what's happened post it and with all the concussion and all that adds to it. It gives you so much opportunity to help others, and I didn't think I'd ever be able to get you on, but something's changed, like you said, in the last few months, and it's awesome to get you on and be able to share this so openly and honestly. It's
just from the experience of Bill, like,
yeah.
Shouldn't have happened. And when Billy passed, I was like, oh no, this is crazy. I was really shocked the first couple of days, and went and seen him up at the hospital, and I was like, man, this is tragic, and I was gutted. But then the next month is when I realised how it shouldn't have happened, and it made me realise how we're not set up for these situations.
Yeah.
We don't have what it takes to help someone in that position, and we're scared of helping them because of what it takes, and you have to be honest about what some of the shit people are dealing with at the moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's what really hurt me and really, really devastated me, was because if you have a situation like that with Bill, with his stuff that he was dealing with in life and his ex-partners and his family stuff, and his financial situation wasn't good, and he was here with the girls and working like hell, man. He's inspired so many of the girls and the FPC team. Like, he used to hang out with them, give them confidence. They've said so many stories since I was with them this year, and how much he looked after them and believed in them. This guy that was beat up really had issues, and he was giving still. And then who was there to help him? Like, and no one's seen it. So that made me realize, man, if we can't see that in someone, if you have problems, we're not safe. Everyone's in a very dangerous position in mental health, and you see this, like, around New Zealand, mental health's never been as bad as it's ever been at this current time. And you see Mike King sacrificing his life for people in our country, you know, and giving so much to try and help the youth especially, and he's up against it because you see someone like him with that much humility sacrificing his time, his effort, his family's life, and then you see our politicians acting like children, using the media to spread false information. They call it misinformation, but really they're just hiding the missing information that's quite often, more often than not, the truth about things that are happening in our country, and mental health's one of them.
100%, and that's why I think you sharing your story is going to help so many people, especially anyone who's had concussion or anyone who's got mental health issues. I think the more people can hear stories like this, the better. It's only going to help. But to hear your story, to hear what you've gone through, super inspiring and super cool to hear how honest you are about it all. And I know it's taken a tough situation and losing Billy to give you the confidence to share your story, and knowing that it's going to help people. But I'm so stoked to get you on the podcast and have you share it.
Cheers, Jim. That's been awesome to be here. And I would say just for Billy's family, like, I suppose just incredibly sorry for the loss.
Mm.
So many of us really loved Bill, what he gave to the union, how he was amongst his peers, not just at Tasman, the three or four super teams he was at, and it's a massive loss and we're all feeling it. So especially his mum and his sisters, they're amazing people, and I'll see them again. So
well said, because like you said, a true legend. Lucky to see him at the Hurricanes environment at the time, and mate, all the guys loved him, mate. Just so honest, very similar to you, like, would just say what he thought and didn't really worry about what people thought, or appeared that way anyway.
He wasn't scared, eh? He wasn't scared of being himself.
No, and that's what I loved about him. He was himself, and he was happy to be himself, didn't care what people thought. So so sad to experience what he went through, and mate, you were awesome at looking after his family post that, and you did awesome work there.
Cheers, Jim.
You're a lad.
You're a lad,
man. Man, what an episode that was. What a lad Shane Christie is. Super grateful to get him on. But if you enjoyed this episode as much as I did, please give it a share. And if you're not following the podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever you listen to your podcast on, then make sure you go and do that so you do not miss another episode and I can continue to grow What a Lad. Finally, if you're a true What a Lad fan, go and get yourself some What a Lad merch at whatalad.com. You will not regret that purchase. What a Lad.